Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, February 16, 2017. A little bit of a frog in my throat, so I'll have to try and talk over this. Hope I make it to the end of this show. And this week's paid cast, by the way, before I forget, a show I've been waiting to do for a long, long time. And the paid cast is a great platform for this. But remember that in the beginning of February, I started my Cosmos series. So I had February 2nd, the introduction. February 9th was part one. That was last week. Next week, I will have part two of the Cosmos series. But every month, I have one episode of the Tesla's Mind series. That's this week. The topic, Tesla versus Einstein. Now, just a quick commentary. I studied classical physics. I studied the developments. I'm a very much a student of the history of science. So not just studying science and what are the equations and how to solve the problems in the back of the book. It's equally important to understand the sequence of events and the timing of scientific discoveries. And there's a lot of hullabaloo about Einstein these days, and I get this from a lot of people. But the reality is that science at the time that Einstein was doing his good work was advancing very rapidly. And there was a body of knowledge that existed. But what did Einstein do? And I'll just tell you very briefly. He opened up the keys. He put the key in the lock and he opened it up and made these magical discoveries, much like Tesla, that probably nobody else would have ever noticed. And these are really subtle, and I'll give you one example of one of Einstein's discoveries. And if you've listened to my paid cast, you certainly understand the genius of Tesla and the discoveries that he made, etc. But Einstein, for example, made the discovery, the intellectual leap, that light travels at the speed of light relative to the observer. So if you send a photon away from you, it leaves you at the speed of light. And now say there's somebody moving away from you at any velocity, but say even a high velocity near the speed of light. When that photon gets to that other person, it's going to arrive at the speed of light. Now, this in classical physics does not make any sense at all. It's like, okay, you've all seen a football game. The quarterback goes back. He throws the ball. He has to lead the receiver. And when the receiver receives the ball, he's running. And so the ball comes to him at a relative velocity. And if he's running almost at the speed that the ball is moving, the ball is just barely catching up to him. And when he catches the ball is just barely moving relative to the receiver. That's classical physics. In Einsteinian relativistic physics, this is special relativity, not general relativity. And remember, I make the point consistently that general relativity is not true. But special relativity has to do with one of the key things that Einstein discovered was that the velocity of light is constant in the frame of reference of the observer. Now, it doesn't make any sense at all. And like I say, I don't know how long we would have gone in the world of physics if Einstein would not have discovered that little teeny, teeny point. But when you then put that back into the equations, which were known about for a long time, the Lorentz transformation was known about for a long time, the way to translate light and velocity and relative motion, and then also the Michelson-Morley experiment, etc., on and on. The ability of Einstein to pick out these little teeny but ultra, ultra important points. If you understand the history of physics, you understand how absolutely immense this was. And then when you boil the equations out of the side, out of nowhere, and you're working with an experiment dealing with light, all of a sudden, all by itself, this little equation pops out called E equals mc squared. Okay, I'm not going to say any more. That's one example of an Einstein very important discovery, and it revolutionized physics. Okay, so anyway, my paid cast for this week, Tesla versus Einstein. Now, Tesla made some discoveries regarding light and electromagnetism also, and also regarding the corpuscular nature of light. In other words, the particle nature of light. So putting these two guys together, and they lived during the same time frame, Tesla being, and Einstein was an experimentalist too. Einstein's results were proven in experiments at the time. And so anyway, I'm not going to talk any more about that now, but a tremendously, what I find as a physicist, as a student of history of science, and then having discovered major discoveries myself, like last week, my show, I talked about the induced electric dipole redshift as a result of understanding non-uniform fields. And so if you understand the history of science, then you understand the importance of certain discoveries and where they come from and how they reshape the future of science. So anyway, not going to say any more about that, but go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and join the paid cast. I really suggest it. And then next week is part 3 of my Cosmos series, Cosmos, The Real Story. And if you're not familiar with that, I'm taking off on the Carl Sagan Cosmos series that occurred in the 1980 timeframe and the Neil deGrasse Tyson Cosmos series that appeared in 2014. And I'm leveraging off those. I'm taking their talking points and then showing that basically the standard scientific concepts don't hold water. And then I'm spending a very short amount of time on that. But then I'm expanding on real science. And one of my criticisms of those Cosmos series, big mega productions for television, is that I call it science entertainment. It's not science, and it's lulled the American public into thinking that that's science. It's really not. It's science entertainment, kind of like Star Wars, but maybe a little more close to what you'd call standard theory. Okay, so anyway, enough of that, but I would suggest going and joining the paid cast. Tonight's main science topic, DNA. Now, I'm also giving this talk tonight because as my regular show last week, I went into some deeper levels of science that I don't have time to do on my paid cast. So these kind of are working back and forth together. If you listen to my paid cast last week, I go into some of these electromagnetic theory concepts, and I don't have time to take one theory and go down to real deep levels. So that's what I did on my regular show last week. So my regular show and the paid cast are somewhat working hand in hand. And so DNA, what about it? And now I'm going to talk about DNA and comets, the plasma discharge comet model. So anyway, that's my main science topic for tonight. I'll be in that in a few minutes. But first, a couple topics. Four things that came in from listeners in Oklahoma. Interestingly, I guess in Wyoming, and there's another state, I believe Nevada, has put a tax on the generation of electricity by wind generators. And so in some states, they pay a subsidy, and in Oklahoma, they had tax credits for wind generators, so alternative energy, green, you know. And all of a sudden, the people are putting in so much of this because of the subsidies that, and like Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is the name I'm trying to think of. Warren Buffett has, this past year, made $28 billion. He was the biggest gainer in the Forbes list of billionaires, head by Bill Gates, something like $75 billion net worth, etc. But Warren Buffett made $28 million, billion, with a B. And a lot of this money came from selling installing wind farms all through Oklahoma, Texas, etc., and working the subsidy market. In other words, they get paid to put these in. So they get them literally for free to install. Then they continue to get subsidies and tax credits. So it's a way for a person with deep pockets to make a lot of money by using these tax credits. But Oklahoma, because they're starting to install so much, and because Oklahoma is an oil state, they're pulling the tax credits and starting to actually charge them at a half a cent per kilowatt hour of electrical energy produced by wind generators. And so this is a flip. But now what's going to happen, since these really don't produce much energy, and since the subsidies are going to go away, and this is happening big time up in Canada, where the fleets, vast areas, especially around the lakes and in Ontario, they have huge numbers, tens of thousands of three-blade wind generators that are subsidized by the government. And up in the western states, there's some also. But when those subsidies dry up within a couple years, and remember that some of these towers are getting $500,000 per year, and that pretty much covers the installation cost. And so if then these subsidies, this is just pure profit and they don't have to produce any energy at all. It's a giant scam. And who's in charge of the Canadian Wind Association? It's General Electric and Siemens and Samsung and all of these other companies that are big in wind energy. But their products don't work. But that doesn't matter. But what's going to happen, once the subsidies dry up, they're going to leave fleets. They're going to leave vast regions with, you know, this decaying dinosaur equipment. And so at any rate, that's just something that's coming along. And so there's a lot going on behind the scenes here in the world of alternative energy. For example, solar panels are being sold all over the place and people are not able to use them. There's examples I've heard of where people will install them, then the government comes in and passes regulations and gives the right to sell solar panels only to the power companies. They go out and install them. The homeowner doesn't even own them. And there's the question, if the central power company shuts down and cannot provide electricity, the homeowner cannot even use the solar panels that are installed on their house. So at any rate, it's becoming a big mess because alternative energy, they're installing so much of it. But I'll tell you something, as soon as the subsidies die, this is going to be dinosaurs all over the countryside, eyesores, and basically, all of this has been paid for out of subsidies that come out of the electrical bills. So the people in Canada are paying humongous prices in spite of the fact they get their energy mainly from hydro. Nothing to do. Hydro is great alternative energy, but they're subsidizing all of this installation of wind power. And it's given wind power a very bad name because it, first of all, doesn't produce any electricity. It's very expensive through subsidies and tax credits. And when the subsidies and tax credits dry up, you know what I bet's going to happen? The government's going to come in and say, oh, poor GE, poor Siemens, we can't let these people just dry up and go away. We got to keep the subsidies going. That's what's going to happen. You can bet. Anyway, that's a complicated mess. And anyway, on to the next topic. When was this? Oh, man, it must have been, oh, okay, I'll put a time on it. It was November of 2015. Yes, November of 2015. I did some shows and a publication on something called STTR 2015. And it was the Road Rehabilitation Act of the United States. And in the back pages, the IRS had a clause by which if someone owed more than $50,000 in back taxes, they could have their passport revoked. And it's rather Orwellian in that, first of all, the number 50,000, I mean, they give $1 million or something for death benefits, or what do you call it? You can will certain up to $1 million or something to your kids, and there's no taxes. Or capital gains, same thing. I don't know if it's a $500,000 or $1 million on your primary residence and no taxes. So why the low number on $50,000 that if people owe the IRS, it's just a arbitrary and capricious number to begin with. And second of all, how is the IRS related to your freedom of travel? And then the third and most important point is that everybody in the United States owes more than $50,000 in back taxes to the IRS. You just simply have not gotten the bill yet. Obama ran up $10 trillion in the national debt. You want to spread that across the population, the taxpaying population. There's lots of people out there that don't pay taxes or file or whatever. So if you take the, say, approximate 300 million people in the United States, cut that by two thirds, so you're left with a third, about a hundred million people that actually file taxes, etc., and that are actually paying something. A lot of them file, but are in that low income bracket where they really don't pay anything. So you're probably down less than that. But at any rate, if you divide that $10 trillion over those people, all of you, the total debt is $20 trillion. Obama in his 8 years added, doubled it. But if you take that and divide it across the taxpaying population, everybody owes more than $50,000. So all of you, Merry Christmas early, thanks to Obama and the Democratic Congress of last, in 2015, when it was passed, and then it was signed into law by Obama. And once again, this law was in the back pages. Now, a law like this would not be even legal in a state like Missouri, where each law that's being passed by the legislative body each bill has to have one specific title. Everything in the bill has to be related to that title. And if you look at the talking points at the beginning of STTR 2015, it doesn't say anything about this IRS inclusion. So at any rate, this stinks to high heaven, let me tell you. And so anyway, more on that in the future. In New Zealand has suffered from imported animals. And now you take an island paradise like New Zealand or Australia. Remember, they brought in various types of animals into Australia. And they just go bananas. And the particular one we're talking about now in New Zealand is a little mouse. And it just has taken over. It's destroying everything, and it's killing off the habitat of the local creatures. And so they can't exist. And so a lot of native species of New Zealand have gone extinct because of this little mouse. But here is what some people are suggesting. It's an alteration in the genetic code of the mice. And what they can do then is by inserting mice into the population that have had their genetic codes altered is that they only produce male offspring. And so eventually there will be a catastrophic failure of the species and they'll all die off and go away. But the implication is that they could do this with people or other species, but more so people. Anyway, just a little bit out of the dungeons of the New World Order. There's been an announcement, and I've seen this many places, a lot of people have sent it in, that in Brazil, supposedly, there are Stonehenge-like circles, and we all know what Stonehenge looks like, these massive stones that were carved into monoliths, and then some stacked on top of the other, etc. And of course, the whole idea here is to create a calendar, and then they have a circle of stones that are going around the outside. There's a similar style structure in Zimbabwe, but what was interesting about the one in Zimbabwe is it was dedicated to Venus. So could that have been built at the time when Venus, the comet, was wandering through the solar system? And of course, it doesn't correspond with Venus as we know it today in its orbit today. And this is characteristic. I was at the various locations, and there was one out, I believe I was in Winslow, Arizona, where that big meteorite crater was. And they had a panel of scientists there that were talking about the petroglyphs and artifacts. And there was a picture of what looked like a comet. And one of the scientists said, oh, well, the natives believe that this is Venus. And he goes, but it couldn't be Venus because it looks like a comet. And I'm like, okay, I'm not even going to say anything here. I am not even going to raise my hand because, you know, excuse me, I'm not going to, certainly I'm not going to change this professional astronomer's mind in all of his textbook study and his strange beliefs. But at any rate, but back to this idea so of Brazil having all of these Stonehenge circles. And so, of course, I'm fascinated by this. I have my Nazca Lines paper, part two that just was released. I suggest that everybody go get a copy of that. You can get that either by ordering it on the secure web ordering page. Go down and click on the Nazca Lines product, and you'll get both part one and part two. You can get it with greater than $100 purchase from the secure web ordering page, more than $100 worth of any conglomeration of products. And then also, if you join the paid cast at the level where you buy the entire ebook library, which is an additional $59, we throw in the Nazca Lines paper for free as a bonus. So those are the different ways that you can get the Nazca Lines paper. So clearly, archaeology, I've spent a lot of time in Mexico crawling up and down the ruins. I surveyed Chichen Itza and Uxmal and many of the other sites, Tulum, only to find out that their true north, that the cities are based on, points to a point in Ontario, which was the old North Pole. And so that's in my work. So obviously, if somebody comes along and says, hey, there's stone hedges all over the Amazon jungle in Brazil, I'm like, huh? Well, I got to see this. So they show the pictures. And all they are is some rectangular, some circular, some not even circular, just some odd-shaped, ring-shaped trenches. There's no stones. There's no circle of pointer stones around the outside edge. There's nothing to indicate that these are astronomically related or directed or designed to give astronomical directions or like solstice or equinox readings. Nothing. They're just circular trenches in the ground. So all I can tell you is I don't know where these news stories come from, but I have yet to see anything that resembles anything that you could design a calendar. Remember that my book, Surviving Planet X Passage, has the design of using a pile of rocks, how to create a calendar. And these are found all over the American Southwest. I designed this, and then later, these people, after I had designed this, people started recognizing these and reporting them. And I go, man, yeah, these people were survivalists. And the reason I put that in my book, Surviving Planet X Passage, was that anybody with a pile of rocks in a couple of hours could build a calendar, decide where the seasons are, and what the equinox date, and basically build a calendar out of a pile of rocks and a clock. Later, I came out with my recalendar sun-star clock that would use either the sun or stars as a calendar device and as a clock. I came out with that, and that's available on my webpage. It's really a beautifully, beautifully printed, very durable device. And it's for $39.95. I don't know how many of those I've sold over the years. Just, you know, lots of them. But anyway, that's available on my webpage. But for, I think it's $44.95 with shipping. Excuse me. And it fits in a briefcase. It fits in a, you know, a student bag or, you know, your travel bag or whatever. And it works in both the northern and southern hemispheres. And it gives you a calendar, and then you can project the calendar far into the future or far into the past. You can correct between your calendar time and watch time. There's a chart for that. And you can do this with either the stars or in the northern and southern hemisphere or the sun. Very beautiful little device. And so I'm very proud of that. But anyways, yeah, so I have a little bit of experience, more than the average dude on the street, dealing with astronomical, you know, creations that can tell time and produce calendars. But nothing, I repeat, nothing that I saw in these pictures from Brazil indicate that there was a Stonehenge-like device in Brazil. So if anybody sees anything where there's actual rocks or pointers or anything else, and there's actual, you know, boots on the ground looking at this and getting directions and directional material, please let me know. But I just wanted to announce that because a lot of times, you know, the news media is so stupid today. Man, this, when you see something, you better really, really, really look at it closely and don't believe everything you see on the standard news media, because it's 99%, you know what. Hip boot, high hip boots, and like I say, you better have some high hip boots and a clothespin, one of those snapping clothespins for your nose when you start reading the news today. Okay, so on to the main science topic, DNA and comets. Now, the year is 2004, around January, and a NASA mission called Stardust flew through the comet tail of Comet Vild 2 and had this like a screen mesh and with gel in it, and they picked up material from a comet tail and then closed it up and brought it back to Earth. And the craft that came into Earth was kind of like a flying saucer looking thing. It was supposed to come in with a parachute, but it it crash-landed in a desert, and so they went out, and it was split open. I remember seeing pictures of this thing, and so they gathered up the stuff, the parts, and brought it back to the laboratory. But anyway, they did discover that in the tail of this comet, there were all of the nucleotides of DNA. Now, the nucleotides are built up primarily of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen. So those four elements, and the DNA is also has phosphorus as one of the elements that builds the DNA chains, as one of the essentials. But if we look at these, now I was talking with a chemist just earlier in the evening, And that's what kind of inspired me to deal with this topic. So in physical chemistry, you study the physics of how molecules are formed, how the atoms go in, and how the bonding, the covalent bonding, the electrical exchange occurs to hold these things together. And it turns out that those four elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen, have a outer electron shell that has available electrons to share, but only one to accept. Or in the case of carbon, there's four available what they call holes. So the electrons from another adjacent atom can come in and join. And that's why carbon can make diamonds, can make these amazingly complex, strong bonds. And so you have graphene and other carbon constructs, which are unique because of the very nature of the electrical shells, the outer electrical shell, which does the covalent bonding. Nitrogen has three spaces available for sharing. Oxygen has two and hydrogen has one. And so here's the point. When you build the nucleotides, these are the organic molecules that are the basis. There's four nucleotides. When you build these with those four atoms and they combine, there's no other possibility for any other atom, any place in the universe, to come in and join the party, so to speak. And so that's why DNA is such an amazing structure. And the amazing thing is that DNA on the far side of the universe is going to be the same as here. That's part of the principle of the base underlying principle of my book, The Diamond Principle. That if you found a diamond on this side of the universe, would you think it's the only diamond in the universe? Or would you start to look for more? Well, history tells us that people are going to look for more. And so once you find more, you find that every diamond is different. If you look at any particular diamond, the fractures in there, the fracture lines, the structure, the coloration, there's all of the different factors that make a diamond what it is in the classification, etc. But an expert can look at a diamond and tell it that, yeah, that's such and such a diamond. And you cannot duplicate this by any mechanical means. But diamond is really the hardest substance that we use in the mechanical world. It's used in saw blades and in all kinds of devices because it's hard. And by the way, that's why diamonds could not possibly be made in the center of the earth. Supposedly there's these crushing forces that force diamonds into like carbon. I remember this one Superman episode where somebody gave Superman a piece of carbon, like charcoal. You'd use in your charcoal grill, and Superman puts it in his hand and he does the Superman crunch on it, and out comes this diamond. And so anyway, the problem with that is in working in the earth is how do all the softer materials, since diamond is the hardest material, how do they create enough pressure to force diamond into becoming a diamond? And of course, it doesn't work. It does not work. So the real source of diamonds is in the fabrication, in the electrical side, the sunward side of comets. Now, there are experiments, and I explain this in my books, that diamonds have been duplicated in the laboratory with the following conditions. You take carbon, you vaporize it, you put in an electron beam, and it forms diamonds. And that's how diamonds are formed. They have detected rings of diamonds around other stars. When the mastodons and the woolly mammoths died off, they were peppered with microdiamonds. So the event, the apocalyptic event that occurred that killed off the mastodons and woolly mammoths, was accompanied by a spray, a literal high-velocity rain of microdiamonds And the bones of the mastodons that are sticking out of the river embankment up in Alaska and in other places are just littered with holes. And at first they didn't know what caused all these holes. Could it be a worm or could something else? And then they started digging in, and these holes, at the pit of each one of these holes was a microdiamond. And if you looked at the bones on the bottom side, there were no holes. So this rain of high-velocity microdiamonds came from where? Up there, from the sky. And so anyway, by the way, I'll just give you a little hint. One of the discoveries that is in my new Part 2 Nazca Line papers has to do, it's related to this topic. And so anyway, I encourage you to go get that, the Nazca Lines Part 2. So at any rate, getting back to these basic atomic building blocks, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, the basic building blocks of DNA, and you find these in a comet tail. Well, excuse me, you also find water in comet tails. You find carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, ammonia. You find the long and short hydrocarbon chains, what we call oil. Everything from the low ones, the high volatile ones, benzene, and all the way up to the heavy chains, which we call crude oil, are found in the tails of comets. So comet tails are breeding factories for organic chemistry. Now, there's something I talk about regularly on my show. It was discovered in the 1200s by the Chinese, and they recognized that during the inferior conjunction of Venus, that's when Venus moves directly between us and the sun, there was a spike in the flu epidemics. And so they realized this, and I mean, this is noted in ancient Chinese medicine. And it's also corroborated in modern medicine. It's published, these articles are published in the modern journals of medicine, that there's a spike in what we call bird flu during the inferior conjunction of Venus. Also during the inferior conjunction of Venus, there's a spike in the sunspots. So clearly the Earth aligning with Venus is causing these two things. And according to my plasma discharge comet model, Venus and Earth are still acting as comets when they align. We get that electrical alignment that kicks up the solar activity, which creates an excess of sunspots, which in turn kicks out more solar wind, which exasperates the condition more. And so, but what's going on with this increase in viruses coming from the tail side of Venus? Well, Earth moves through the tail of Venus, the planet, which still sports a comet tail, which extends out beyond Earth. We move through that. We pick up the viruses. What's a virus? A virus is a abnormal, poorly constructed, let's put it that way, DNA chain. And so your body cannot recognize it. When it comes in, it rains, you outside breathing, and you breathe this in, and your body takes this in, and your immune system goes, oh man, I'm getting a load of something here, and I don't recognize it. So your body kicks up. And so all your flu symptoms are to defend your body and make the mucus, etc., that gets rid of this virus. And then also in the process, your body, your immune system builds up the coating to go, if you ever see that baby again, don't even let it in the door, get rid of it, flush it out. And that's why you have to drink a lot of water when you have a cold or liquid fluids, etc., is to flush that stuff out. And a lot of people just lay down, but you should be eating fruit, apples, all those things that cleanse your body, because that's what your body's trying to do, is get rid of those unrecognizable partial DNA. That's what a virus is. Okay, so, and a lot of times people ask me if my water filters will filter out viruses. We have tests that show in some cases that they do, but it's not something we advertise as in the testing, because you get into all kinds of medical claims and counterclaims and all of that. So it's like we don't even go there. We deal with organic, inorganic chemicals, heavy metals, arsenic, fluoride. And remember, there's two kinds of fluoride. There's natural fluoride, which is not harmful. There's the fluoride, which is a chemical slew mix that they put in toothpaste and in the water, which is not good for you. You got to get that out of your water. But anyway, these are all organic chemicals, and you need a special process to get them out of the water. It's not filtration, it's absorption. And so that's why a lot of people have to sell add-on filters to get those chemicals out of the water. And my filters are the only ones that have all-in-one, where you get all of those removed out of a single filter element without any add-on. So, oh well, a little bit of advertisement thrown in the middle. But anyway, this gives you an idea about the organic chemistry that's in water, just in nature. So anyway, back to comet tails. What's going on in the tail of a comet? Well, what is a comet? A comet is the discharge of the solar capacitor. Excuse me. The electron stream that's coming out from the sun charges up the nucleus to a net negative value. And because the electrons arrive in larger numbers, the incoming, infalling positive ions in the tail to neutralize that cannot come in fast enough, so that keeps the nucleus negatively charged. But when these ions come in, the carbons, the oxygens, the nitrogens, the hydrogens, the phosphorus, the sulfur, whatever's out in outer space there in atomic form, when these come in, they start combining, and they'll combine readily because they're looking for that electron donor and receptor in the covalent bonding. And so you get the buildup of organic, and primarily these organic molecules. And it's not too surprising, if you understand this, that you're getting the nucleotides that are the basis of DNA. And if you let it go long enough, you might even find some big organic compounds in the tail of a comet. So given that, let's take a little trip over to the other side of the universe, where we have fusion-based stars. We have proton winds coming out of those fusion-based stars. We have objects coming into solar systems, planetary systems that are evolving around other stars, very similar to our own star. Is there going to be a nucleotide development in the tail of those comets? Yes, of course there is. Is that going to lead into the buildup of DNA molecules? Well, possibly not in the comet tail, but once those nucleotides they fall into, say, a planet moves through those are going to fall into the atmosphere. And then through for example, Venus, I've said in my work that Venus right now is in what we call the nuclear stage. In other words, it has a very high heat content in the core of Venus. It's still belching out that heat. The molecular structure in the atmosphere of Venus is super volatile, very powerful chemicals. CO2 is a big constituent. You have ammonia, sulfuric acid. You have other chemicals in the atmosphere of Venus. And eventually, the whole planet will cool down. Excuse me, I'm kind of fighting through this cold here that I got. But eventually the planet will cool down, and as it does, the construction of these nucleotides will certainly be there, and then the building of these into DNA forms. And now, here's the part also. Let me be real specific, that there's a war going on between creationists and so-called science evolutionary scientists. And the evolution scientists are saying, well, this is just all a natural process. It happens without any redirection. And then there's the evolution or the creationist people that say, well, God steps in and creates man and creates the animals and the beautiful creatures in the sea and the peacocks and the ducks and the elephants and everything else. So literally, we do not have data. And as a scientist, you need data. There's evidence that people had some interference in the DNA development of the human race. There is verbal evidence that goes back into ancient texts, and there is also apparent physical evidence that if you look at people and you look at supposedly our ancestors, they have to come up with something called the missing link. The thing that they can't find, the creature they cannot find to link us to monkeys. Maybe the monkey evolved from man. Maybe we're in the process of evolving into a stupid race. You know, that could be, I could convince a lot of people of that theory. So we don't know. We don't have real data on all of these transitions of DNA and development of species, etc. Velikovsky made the point that the change in species happens in radically quick time frames when the species are under severe stress. And that's when the variant forms of DNA that are typically not seen kick in, and one of those might be a bit more successful than another. And Stephen Jay Gould actually stole this idea, was posthumously rewarded for his theft as being the originator of this idea. But of course, Velikovsky's additional story was that this happened primarily when large, like the Venus event, when a large comet came through the solar system and the entire Earth was stressed. Now, we can go back in the history of the planet Earth and we can see 20 epochs of mountain building. And this would have corresponded also with the epochs of mass extinctions. Well, gee, guess who your prime suspect is in this game of Clue? Was it the butler with the candlestick or the maid with the... I forget all of the... You ever play Clue when you're a kid? We used to play that all the time. And was it in the den or was it in the library, you know, etc. You had to figure all this out. And so a very fun game. But in the game of science in so-called evolution or creationism, and by definition, we were not around in our knowledge base. We were not around when we were created. So we really don't know. We don't have what you would call in the scientific sense, we don't have data. So anybody who calls themselves a scientist and claims they know where they came from, I would just go back to their own birth. Were you conscious when you were born and you have a record of that? The reason you know about it is because your parents tell you, because they were there, they were adults, they were cognizant, and that's how you know. But when the human race was born, there was nobody around with a GoPro or a nice camera taking pictures. So we really don't know. We do not have good data. But we can surmise some things. We can see evolutionary change going on. And we can see, for example, back in the mastodon days, there were all kinds of creatures that went extinct. The saber-toothed tiger, the woolly mammoths, the mastodons, etc. Those big animals had grown up on a planet where there was plenty to eat because they were big animals. An animal like that packs away a lot of food. And so they went extinct, and out of that that lineage of the animals that existed possibly came modern man and lots of other animals, horses, moose, deer, antelope, the llamas, all kinds of other animals have come through the chain of events that lead us up to today. And of course, we have this in any type of agriculture. You can trace corn back to a little grain, and it was handpicked and prospered. over the millennia to where it's corn that we see today, a big, great big ear of corn and the many different varieties that were cultured by people who knew how to cross-pollinate and mix different types with benefits of one and the other, so resistivity to mold and insects, etc. And so we see that. But is that evolution? Is that a new species? No, it's not a new species. And that's what Velikovsky was pointing out, that a different strain or a different variety of the same species, sure, those have developed, but is it a new species? That's a totally different question that even I think Darwin, if it were posed to him today, would have a difficult time answering. So, okay, so back to the concept of DNA. Now, the helical structure of DNA is well known, the double helix, and these are held together by chains of very stable connectors. In other words, the structure of DNA is held together, the two chains, by bridges, and those bridges are equally sound. In other words, it's like if you built a bridge and you have cars driving across it, or trains, or whatever. You have to build the structure underneath so that it's sound and that nothing else can come in and affect it over a long period of time. And so the same type of structure exists for DNA. The bridging between the helical coils is very stable chemically. They say that the shark DNA has a half-life of 25,000 years. So shark DNA is very stable. You can put the that's why the shark has maintained exactly as the shark. We see sharks, you know, encrusted in sand or the fossils, etc. From, you know, millions of years ago. It has not changed significantly in that time because the DNA is so stable. I'm not sure if we can say that about humans, but certainly animals in the ocean, and also the animals in the ocean are not subject to the severe environmental changes that occur when large comets come by the Earth. They drastically affect the atmosphere, the content of the various mixes of chemicals in our atmosphere, the moisture content, the density of the atmosphere, all kinds of the temperature. We know how sensitive plants are to temperature and humidity, etc. So when there's a major disruption, there's a lot of shifting and changing. Plants that were not there before all of a sudden prospering, etc. And so the development of the plants that we see today, when we say ecosystem, it's very much a very complex, interdependent group of species. And we depend on the ants, and the ants depend on us, and the bees, and the flowers, and all different types of plants. They say if you had one type of plant, like say an oak tree, you had one oak tree out in the middle of a field and the whole earth had only that one oak tree, that within, I forget what it is, you know, within 100 years, the whole earth would be covered with oak trees. That's how fast it would propagate. But that's not the case. When all of those seeds and the acorns fall from the oak tree, only one out of all of those that fall over all of those years, only one grows to become another oak tree in place of the parent oak tree because of all the competition. So all of these factors come into controlling what we see in the environment. But man has this special ability to control his environment, to change it, to alter it, different from any other animal or plant. And so we have the ability to foster the planet Earth and take care of it, or we have the ability to turn it into exactly what's happening today. Resources for economic gain and just absolutely destroying the planet that gives us life. And so anybody who thinks they're going to move to another planet in the near future and all of a sudden we're going to find another planet and it's going to be paradise and we're all going to move there, I got news for you, buddy. Ain't going to happen. Certainly not in your lifetime. So better start taking care of the planet we're given here. And very simply, and that's why I spend a lot of my time trying to get to a point where we have resources that we live within our means. At any rate, I'm a couple minutes left here. I'm going to divert to a couple different topics. But there's some interesting things going on with the alternative energy projects that I'm working on. Let's just put it that way. And so I thought I would be ready for an announcement this week, but we're taking a few looks at a few other issues. But basically, keep your ears to the railroad track here, because there's a couple different efforts underway. And all I can tell you is I'm not going to mention any more at this point, other than just keep your ear to the rail. On my water filter page, my product pricing has changed considerably. And so now the water filter come with two filter elements, and the prices have been reduced greatly because of that. And then I want to sponsor people buying extra filter elements in the packages, and also the personal filters, 1 and 2 liter filters, the prices have come down on those. So I invite you to check those out. And the remember the Nazca Lines new release is out, and the paid cast. The Cosmos series started in February. It's really a must listen. I mean, you to be an educated person today, you really have to listen to that. And as I said, my topic for this week is the topic I've been waiting a long time to do this, called Tesla versus Einstein, something that really you do want to listen to. And the paid cast buttons are available. Just scroll down on my homepage, jmccsci.com. Click on the link to go to the sub page where all the buttons are for the various options for buying the paid cast. You can buy it with all the months going back to August, which I encourage everybody to do. Or you can get it with for a reduced price, my ebook, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. Or you can get my entire ebook library for an extra $59, which is $10 off the regular price. And so anyway, thank you for listening again. Have a great audience. It's not the biggest audience in the world, but a very dedicated audience. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Listen to the paid cast. This is Jim McKinney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.